Hello and welcome to That's What She Said, the intersectional feminist podcast with me, Hannah Thacker.
And me, Nina Attridge.
Hey.
Hello.
How are you? It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while on the airwaves.
Yeah.
Not a while for us.
But it's like riding a bike.
Is
just
it?
Straight back on that bike.
Yep.
Don't fall over.
Don't fall off.
Yeah.
Don't crash into anything.
No. And don't use just like one of your brakes. Use both.
Wow. Okay. I don't know what metaphor that applies to here.
This is just bike tips.
Emotional brakes.
This is the podcast where you learn how to ride a bike.
From a feminist perspective.
Well, I mean, there's quite a lot of ground to go over, but this is our first episode that we're recording in our new flat.
We live together now.
We do.
We're the only podcasters in the world that live together. I don't know anyone else that does it.
Couples?
Yeah, they don't count.
I mean, they live together, but...
Maybe. Yeah, I suppose so. That's just a different world though, isn't it?
Yeah. There must be some.
Yeah. Mm. I've not heard of any, so I'm going to pretend we're the first.
Okay, breaking ground here. Pioneers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Someone's going to make a podcast about us in 50 years.
Mm-hmm. What's their pod... Well, let's not get into those realms of possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Well, any highlights from recent weeks?
Oh my goodness. Yeah, it's been so long. Moving in here has been a big thing, and mm-hmm. that has been pretty much consuming
mm-hmm.
a lot of time. Quit a job, got a new job. Nothing feminist. I can't think of, have I done anything feminist? I don't think I have. You don't have to like look around the room like shit. If I can't remember, you probably won't.
Yeah.
Hannah's got more to report on that front, so I'll just let you... Take the wheel, Jesus.
Jesus?
Jesus, take the wheel.
How dare you? well, stuff. I went to the People's Vote March mm-hmm. in London at the weekend, which was like the 23rd, March 23rd, March 22nd, one of them,
mm-hmm.
which was like really cool. There was a lot of great placards, which I'm sure you'll be able to find online.
We put some on the socials, didn't we? You did.
Oh, I just took a picture of when I was there and just like, I was just stood on a wall and just cheering intermittently. yeah, that was my contribution.
Yeah.
I started volunteering for Every Month,
mm-hmm.
which is a period poverty charity, which is, that's good.
That's a good thing to do.
Yeah.
That ticks some of those old feminist boxes.
Boxes?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's other stuff, but those are like the most recent things.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure the people are dying to know more, but shall we crack on with some news?
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
Cool. So on March 4th, Switchboard, which is the oldest LGBTQ+ helpline in the UK, celebrated its 45th anniversary.
Nice.
Very cool. It was originally founded in a small room above a bookshop near King's Cross Station, and was originally called London Lesbian and Gay Switchboard. And for 45 years, the helpline has provided a safe space for LGBTQ+ people to discuss topics including sexuality, gender identity, sexual health and emotional well-being. Currently, the Switchboard takes over 30,000 calls each year.
Shit.
It's a lot.
That's a lot.
Mm-hmm. The reason that I saw this was thanks to an article in Another Man.
New to me.
Yeah, new to me as well. We like these new ones. By a journalist called Lewis Staples, who interviewed 5 people on why Switchboard means so much to them. And as you can imagine, all 5 contributions were great.
Mm-hmm.
However, I've got 2 quotes from it that I think are just lovely. So this one comes from Neil McCullough, a trustee and listening volunteer, has this to say. Switchboard has taught me humility. It's an absolute privilege to be able to listen to people who open up to you and discuss things they don't feel they can tell anyone else. Society is changing and the LGBTQ+ community is changing too. But Switchboard continues to evolve to meet these changes. As long as people want to call us, Switchboard will keep listening. I've got another quote which comes from a former caller saying, if someone on the other end of the line, He's called Mark Rounding, and he also shared his experience. LGBT Switchboard's 45th birthday is an opportunity to say thank you. Just for being there and knowing you existed made a world of difference to me and becoming secure in my identity as a gay man. I wish it well as it continues to help people to be true to who they are and assist with the confusion and conflicts that so often accompany the journey to being the real you. It's so lovely.
So how old? 45?
Yeah, 45.
So there'll be some people that used that when they were in their 20s. Now looking back, like, my life wouldn't have been what it has been without that phone call.
Yeah, there were several. There were several of them that were like, I first called when I was 14, I first called when I was 12. Just like, who else can they turn to?
Yeah, that's good work. Mm-hmm. That is some good quality service.
Yeah, there was like, I can't remember which person it was, and they were just like, I first started calling up to see what was going on in my area.
Listings of events and shit.
Yeah, like, just like, are there some gay people meeting up for an event?
Yeah, that's funny. I enjoy that. Not for like the cinema listings or whatever. Like,
do you know what? I bet they would tell you as well.
I wonder how big a team it is and stuff. I'd be interested to know, like,
Ask me so many questions I don't have the answers
I'm only,
to.
I'm not asking them, I'm wondering. It's different.
Yeah, apparently I have a lot of volunteers. Yeah. So.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's some good positive one to start.
Get
on,
us started,
it?
Yeah. What are you going to hit us with now?
Yeah, I know. It was like, oh shit, is this going to be a jolly one? Because didn't get the memo. No, it's fine. I've got a story now that I personally have thought about a lot. It's one of the things I was thinking the other day, actually, about, like, very, very intense, but I was thinking about how I'm going to, like, center my life towards doing things that I feel like good in the world. And, like,
okay.
But you know how, like, overwhelming it is with when there's so many things that you care about and so many things that, like, you feel like you should care about, or, like, so many things that need to change in the world. I decided to, like, have a sit down with myself and think about which ones I can feel like I can enact the most change in, or I'm the most personally passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I thought about was one of the things I thought about was the issue of contraception for women. Just because I think the gender imbalance of it is so immensely deep and horrible, the burden on women to take hormonal contraception, which has been proven to have so much bad an impact on mental health.
Mm-hmm.
So on that note, I found this article, I think it was called Where the Hell is Male Contraception? But I didn't read the headline and then just wrote it down as Where the Fuck is Male Contraception? Like, that's basically what I was thinking anyway.
Yeah, I like that more.
Yeah. So this is an article from Broadly, you know, the Vice sub.
We've been
to Broadly before. Yeah, so where the fuck is male contraception? So it talks about the fact that in the media there's been intermittently now for years articles basically saying, like, birth control for men is coming soon. Mm. And obviously we've seen nothing of that, really. So the article interviews a researcher called Diana Blythe, who's been working on trying to develop a male contraceptive since 2005. And she's talking about how when she sees these news stories saying male birth control coming soon, she gets so frustrated because she's working on it and she knows how far away we are from that actually being a reality. So basically this article is just outlining where we're up to with the male contraceptive and the process, the steps that we're going to have to... The Blythe, for example, as a researcher, is going to have to take in between now and there being a fully marketable, fully accessible male contraceptive.
Okay. Yeah, the way they've always said it is, like, it's ready. It's like sitting in a warehouse.
Yeah.
And we're just waiting for like the NHS budget.
She talks a bit about, yeah, that it's kind of a load of urban myths, really.
Okay.
So Blythe works on this contraceptive gel, and this is hers is the one that's the furthest along in clinical trials, and that's very telling given that hers is the furthest along, and she's the one that's saying this isn't going to be ready for years, and that's, and I know this because this is the one I'm working on. So after Blythe finishes the gel's current round of testing, which involves proving that the gel has been effective for the study's 400 participants, and that make, I think they have to say it's effective for all of them for it to get past this stage, then she and her colleagues will need to find another 1,600 men willing to test the product. Obviously, recruiting that takes like several months, and repeating the study is going to take several more months. When that phase is complete, they obviously need the time to analyse and publish the results, and they have to repeat this process for three phases of clinical trials. So we've already got at least 2 years just from this one product's clinical trial span. The results then go to the FDA or whatever it is. This is in the US, this one. So the results would then go to the FDA, and once that gets, the reports get sent to them, they can then send back a report saying you need to prove further aspects of this with more trials. So like they could list any number of, they could like cite any number of areas of the research and say you need to go back and prove this more or this more, which would all mean more and more trials, obviously more and more years basically. There are other male birth control methods like a pill and an injection that are also on the same process, but as Blythe says, sadly, what she's describing is at least 10 years away.
Wow.
I know.
That's so interesting. I was weirdly reading recently about the contraceptive pill and the fact that they can't do clinical trials because it's so unethical. They can do some trials, but they can't, like, this is why you get like, really varying numbers on the effectiveness, like the percentage-wise. Like, some say 98%, some say 99.9%, some say 80%.
Yeah.
Just because they don't actually know.
Yeah. And as I'll say now, the history of how the female contraceptive started is, I'm sure you know bits about it, but it's super rocky. And I'm sure we've spoken about it on the podcast before. The female birth control pill was tested on a Massachusetts, like on patients in a Massachusetts asylum for the mentally ill without their knowledge or consent. And interestingly, at the same time, they were developing a male contraceptive. This is in the 1950s. This is a guy called Gregory Pincus who developed the first female oral contraceptive with the help of a gynecologist called John Rock. So they began testing male and female contraceptives in tandem illegally in this illegally in this Massachusetts. Was it? It might not have even been illegal then to test
I'm
on
sure inmates.
not inmates, but patients, obviously. The Planned Parenthood founder, Margaret Sanger, became interested in the study and encouraged Gregory Pincus and John Rock to abandon the male contraceptive research to focus on the female contraceptive and put money into that, and that is how that got developed.
I wonder if it was just like they were just having more luck with the female one then. You don't really know.
They did just drop it because she was funding it, and there was, it's like they both started at the same time, and the female one got continued because this, she was a women's rights activist and she wanted to prioritise women's independence in terms of contraception, because like saying that men already have condoms, women need their own way.
Yeah.
So don't focus time and energy on another male contraceptive when it's women that need one now, which was the big sort of paradox of the pill being made popular, because it did change so many women's lives immediately, but then that very quickly switched into, okay, now it's women's responsibility.
Yeah.
Like, it was crazy, really. So people still say this, cite this lack of demand for a male pill. So it was the 1950s, and still now we're saying that it's a lack of demand for the male pill or a male birth control that is preventing it from being developed. But there's been research into this, obviously. So after female contraceptive was approved by the FDA and was just blew up in popularity. It was so successful that they stopped all research into a male contraceptive for 10 years.
All right.
They just decided that that wasn't needed because this new female contraceptive was deemed the best thing ever and we didn't need to find an alternative. So to answer the question of demand for a male contraceptive, this article interviews a couple of men about their views on what, like, where they stand on a male contraceptive. And one of them is a guy called Charlie Lanyon, who's a 33-year-old journalist living in Los Angeles, who says he very strongly does want a male contraceptive. He wants to be more responsible. He doesn't want the burden of contraception to fall solely on his partner. He doesn't want to feel like, in his words, a shitbag, which is fair enough. More than anything, he wants to take birth control because his partner cannot. Lanyon's current girlfriend was on an oral contraceptive for 10 years, during which she battled depression and mood swings. After getting off the pill, her mental health drastically improved.
Preaching which to is the just choir.
Insane. Yes. Like, we fucking know. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely mental. Like, I won't take the pill anymore because it's... I don't know how different my life might have been without being on it for 5-6 years, but I know it was bad for me and things started massively looking up when I stopped taking it, and I do not care if, like, I might have to get the morning after pill sometimes because that's... And you start to lose your sanity because you're like, where does me end and the pill start? But yeah, that's a whole other thing.
I think it was not last year, but the year before, I went on Dianat for 3 months, and Dianat's like the notoriously terrible one for your mental health. I lost myself. I had didn't know what was up or down, didn't understand anything that was going on in my own head and my emotions.
It's crazy what it can do to you, and that's one of the reasons, because I'm big into mental health stuff, like, that's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this, because it's just the complete loss of of who you are on it. Like, it shouldn't have to be something that we suffer alone. Or, as Lanyon puts it, if you look at it this way, the argument is saying, please go back and be depressed again in order for us to be able to have sex. That's horrible, he says. It's not like no one's doing their part, there's just really no option. It's like, does she want to be miserable, or do we want to take consistent birth control? It doesn't seem fair. No shit. Like, I agree with you, Lanyon, but there's another guy they interview called Jelani Rice, a 25-year-old photographer living in Brooklyn, who also believes the available birth control methods are unfair. Rice recalled a relationship in which his partner assumed she had to get on birth control if they were going to date. It made Jelani feel like he was controlling her decisions about her body. I almost feel like men just assume that's just what a woman does, and women also assume that that's what they have to do, he said.
Yeah.
It's fair enough.
I think it's kind
of, you're kind of pinned as irresponsible for not being on it, and I think that's one of the most frustrating narratives that we've woven about it. But yeah, that relationship Jelani and the girlfriend he was talking about has since ended, but Rice still sees a need in his life for male birth control. He wants to have sex as safely as possible, and hoping that a woman has been taking her pill on time, or that she changed her patch on the right day, doesn't feel like enough. It is a lot to, like, trust in a partner as well, and it shouldn't just be a one person job.
Yeah, take responsibility for your own your own sexual activity, for your own contraception, as much as you can.
Yeah. Both of these men interviewed say that they understand that, like any other medication, birth control will include side effects, and they're okay with that. You'll probably remember in the media a few years ago, when the articles about male contraception were doing the rounds, there was a lot of talk about men not being willing to tolerate the side effects of the medication, and they were citing the side effects as being, what was it, muscle pain, intense changes in mood, and acne. So obviously every single woman that saw that was like, can you absolutely fuck off, we've been dealing with this and worse for but I also read at the time, I mean, because it was very much a clickbaity headline stuff, I did read the stuff at the time saying that no, they were a lot worse than that. It was extreme cases of that are worse than the female contraceptives, or like they hadn't developed it. Yeah, Okay. So it wasn't just that. There was like cited in the side effects from that study that was doing the rounds. There was a case of very severe depression and intentional overdose. One subject who had to stop the treatment because he was getting an abnormally fast and irregular heartbeat, which is not something that I think is particularly common with female contraception. However, the results... it's a bit weird, this. However, the results of the study were largely positive. Okay. 75% of the men reported that they'd still be willing to use the product despite some of the more minor side effects, which is a high rate of satisfaction for any study, 75% apparently. So okay. I'm assuming that there was largely the same minor side effects and a few extreme cases, which I know will happen with female contraceptives.
Yeah, of course. But it happens with any drug that you put into your body. The female contraceptive pill does work for some people. Mm. Like, I have friends who are on it and they're like, feel the same.
Yeah.
I kind of wonder what I'd be like if I wasn't on it, but it doesn't really affect me enough to be that curious.
Yeah.
Where there are some friends, like, you know, you and I, who can't go on it.
Yeah.
Because it's so extreme, the reaction.
It's not worth it. I don't know. Yeah. I envy people that have agreed with it or haven't had the same side effect, but I just... I'm just scared of putting hormones into my body now, really, in any way.
Yeah, for sure.
Blythe said it makes sense that large swathes of men are interested in the product. Men are already using birth control at high rates. Male condoms and vasectomies both rank among the top five most common forms of birth control.
And you can reverse vasectomy.
Exactly,
you can't reverse a hysterectomy.
Mm, they talk about that. Blythe says men say they don't like using condoms. If they had another option, would they use it? I think the answer is yes. Research suggests there's truth to Bly's theory. A recent survey from the Male Contraceptive Initiative found that 8.1 million men in the US are very likely to use new male contraceptive methods, while 5.6 million are somewhat likely. That's some big stats, isn't it? I don't know the US population, but...
I don't have a clue.
Sounds like a lot of
people. Lots of numbers. Yeah.
Those
are some big ass numbers.
Another study published in the National Center for Biotechnology Information in 2002 found that 75% of male partners of women who had recently given birth would consider trying male hormonal contraception. I've only just thought about that, and that's hilarious. Like, no more of
this again.
Yeah. Why did I not find that funny the first time I read
it?
Still, however, tubal sterilization, a procedure that closes the fallopian tubes, remains four times more popular than vasectomies, even though the latter is far less intrusive and often reversible.
Yeah.
I know. And I was really surprised
at that. And we stop trying to make babies at a certain point. And guys, they can just keep doing it the whole time. So
it's,
be responsible for your junk in that trunk.
That's a different junk.
It's all the same junk to me.
Cheeky. There have not been many polls, basically, since the early 2000s, gauging interest in a male contraceptive. So there's not really much statistical research to back up a need for one.
Mm-hmm.
But Stephanie Page, who works in the Metabolism, Endocrinology and Nutrition Department for the University of Washington.
Oh, fancy.
Yeah. Says there's been a lot of social change in the last 10 to 15 years, and I would say there's probably even more interest in a male contraceptive than before, which I would agree with. Still, as far as the pharmaceutical industry is concerned, the market for male birth control is unknown because it remains hypothetical. Many new drugs we see on the market are either longer acting forms of something that already exists or treat a disease or disease state, so we know how many people might take it. With male birth control, that's unknown because there's nothing like it available on the market already.
Mm. But I'm sure they had that same...
They would have had that with...
...question with the female. Yeah. Like, you don't know how many people are going to take it until you put it out there.
Yeah. When studies on male birth control resumed in the 70s after they'd had their little break because they thought female birth control was so great, there was a major breakthrough that with the continued use of testosterone, they could suppress men's sperm counts to effectively infertile levels, which they don't say at this point, but they say later on, In the 90s and early 2000s, scientists conducted similar studies involving giving men high doses of testosterone, this time with larger and more diverse subject pools, and crucially with the backing of pharmaceutical companies. But while effective, the excess testosterone caused many men to experience an array of undesirable side effects, like the inability to ejaculate and maintain muscle mass, as well as low libido and extreme mood swings, which, again, some of that sounds a bit like this is similar to female side effects, but I do think these were worse.
And also, that, like, shouldn't be the gold standard. It's like, no, exactly. Oh, but they're just the same as the female contraceptive pill, because that's so great.
Mm. No, exactly.
We should be aiming for something better.
Yeah. So the past few decades of research have been able to correct for these problems. Hormonal contraceptives currently being tested for male use, gels, injections, and pills, typically use testosterone in conjunction with a second hormone or hormone compound to stop sperm production while also regulating testosterone levels in the rest of the body.
Mm. Sounds sciencey.
It is sciencey, isn't it? Mm. The positive to all this is that all of the researchers interviewed in this article are in agreement that once the first male contraceptive gets off the ground, it won't be the same way for more to follow, and it should be much more quick for there to be, as I think it was Paige, one of the researchers, puts it, creating a menu of choices for men, which we do have as women. We have a lot of options.
Yeah, and once it's on the market as well, like you've raised before, then the demand will like show itself, like how how in demand is it, and with that then comes investment and funding, blah blah blah. Yeah. So
yeah,
interesting. Mm-hmm. I honestly thought there was that one ready to go.
No, God. There is nothing ready to go.
Well, there's never an easy way to segue.
No.
So I'll just go. So this was an article in Forbes. By Laura Begley? Laura Begley Bloom? About the first black woman who is a cruise ship captain.
Nice.
So there's a little bit of history in the old maritime world to get us on the ball.
Love me a bit of maritime history.
Who doesn't? So until the 1970s, many professional maritime academies didn't admit women. And there were no women cruise ship captains until 2007.
Okay. How long have there been cruise ship captains?
Cruise ships have been going for a while, wasn't...
Since the Titanic.
Wasn't the Titanic a cruise ship?
Yeah.
And they had them before that.
No, it wasn't a cruise ship, was it?
No, it wasn't a cruise ship. Yeah. Apparently they had them in the 70s, so... I feel like it's a very Mad Men thing. The Mad Men was like the 50s, 60s.
I've never seen Mad Men. And I didn't know it was on a cruise ship, so I'm learning something new every day.
I don't know if there was a cruise ship either. I'm just saying it seems like it's something they would do. However, at the minute, women make up 18 to 20% of the workforce in the world of cruise ships and maritime stuff.
Yep.
Yep.
That industry.
I'm so knowledgeable about all of it. However, you know, this is a very sort of like the further you go up in terms of like ranking, the more unequal it gets.
Okay, as the world does.
Yeah, so, so true. Of the more than 300 passenger cruise ships worldwide, fewer than a dozen women captains have been at the helm. And it's a rarity to find women in the upper echelons of the cruise industry, since they only account for 5.4% of officers.
Okay, officers.
So you can have like first officer, second officer,
okay,
captains.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, you know, the titles and stuff. Like, I don't know.
Something important.
Yeah, 5.4% of officers. That's all you need to know.
Okay, yeah.
However, in 2016, so this article was published this year.
Okay.
But this actually is referring back to 2016.
How has it only just been published?
Okay. Well, there was a few small articles about this woman, but no real big ones. So okay. I think it was to tie in with Women's History Month.
Right, okay.
For Forbes. So in 2016, Belinda Bennett, which is a wonderful name. Belinda Bennett.
my dad wrote a porno.
Oh no, don't do it.
I'm sorry.
So Belinda Bennett made history as the first black woman to become a cruise ship captain. She has worked for a small ship line for 14 years and sails the MSY Windstar through the Caribbean in winter and Europe in summer. She recently won the UK's prestigious Merchant Navy Medal for meritorious service.
What is a meritorious service?
A service worth merit.
I didn't know merit had an adjective
with
it. Many
merits.
Much merit.
In the interview with Forbes, Belinda said, "I had goals in life, which I've succeeded at, and I'm a very strong woman. Being a woman, you have to work extra hard to prove yourself, even more than a man. Some men might not like that, but that's the way it is. I'm driven, I wanted to be a captain, and so I am."
Oh, nice.
Mm. Big up, as Nina would say.
Easy. Yeah. Well, that's all right, isn't it? Good
yeah.
Work.
Very, very monumental there.
Mm-hmm. Shall I take us back to dry land?
Please do take us back to dry land.
Okay, with pleasure. So the government has allocated funding for free sanitary products in all English secondary schools and colleges, which has been welcomed as a huge step by campaigners.
That's amazing.
I don't want to praise the government, but we're going to praise that this has happened.
Well, it's the hard work of the campaigners.
Exactly, yeah. So Amika George, I think you might, yeah, who is 19, she started campaigning on period poverty 2 years ago. She said this move would make a massive difference to girls who struggle to afford tampons and pads, which makes, it's a bit of an understatement phrase that, she would have said more than that. And this is what she's been campaigning for years. This is massive. However, other campaigners did say it should include primary schools. So Chancellor Philip Hammond made the announcement in his spring statement. He said the government was responding to concerns from head teachers that some girls were missing school because they could not afford sanitary products. 1 in 10 girls between the ages of 14 and 21 in the UK have been unable to afford sanitary products, while 49% have missed an entire day of school because of their period, according to research by Plan International. Last year, the Scottish Government announced a £5.2 million scheme to provide free sanitary products in schools, colleges and universities. So the Treasury said the Department for Education of England, of Great Britain, or the UK. The British Government. Okay. Amika George, now a student at Cambridge, was inspired to start campaigning on the issue after reading about period poverty in the news. She said she was shocked to find out girls were missing school because of not having sanitary products. I was still at school myself at the time and I couldn't imagine having to deal with that. In 2017, she started a petition calling for the government to fund free sanitary products in schools, using social media to build support for her campaign. Big up social media. Just a few months later, she organised a protest outside Downing Street, which attracted around 2,000 people. That's insane. Like, I want to organise a protest that can get that many people. In January this year, she launched a legal campaign alongside the Red Box Project and the Pink Protest, arguing that period poverty was denying some girls their right to education. Reacting to the funding announcement, Miss George said, "It was an amazing first step, and the government had finally taken action against period poverty." However, she did say the scheme should also be available in primary schools, as some children can start menstruating as young as 8, and it should be enshrined in law to ensure future governments had a legal obligation to maintain the commitment. Gemma Abbott from the Red Box Project, which provides free sanitary products to schools across the country, agreed the announcement was a huge step forward and long overdue. Ms. Abbott said her organisation had been contacted by hundreds of schools asking for help to provide products for their students. Many schools relied on individual teachers to provide tampons and sanitary pads, or even charged pupils because they did not have the funds to give them out for free. Schools do their best, but it's really important that we relieve schools of this burden, she added. She said some girls were forced to use toilet roll, newspaper or socks because they could not pay for sanitary products. The experience of being unable to access these products can develop can affect a child's ability to reach their potential. Who is going to be able to concentrate properly in lessons if you're worried about leaking or spending your lunch money on sanitary products? Ms. George said she hoped her campaign had also helped tackle the stigma around periods. Part of the reason period poverty hasn't been addressed is because of the taboo around the subject, she said. But now so many more people are talking about it, it's almost like there's a period revolution happening at the moment. She said the campaign also showed the impact young people could have. I was literally 17 years old doing it from my laptop in my bedroom, she said. I think it's a testament to the fact that politics is really changing at the moment. Young people don't have to rely on MPs to start campaigns. They can do it themselves using social media.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of an NGO, of pressure groups. It's not all about party politics. Mm-mm. There's a lot we can do without being party political.
Yeah.
I think that's really important.
And that's, yeah, like period poverty is one place that we are seeing real change because of like the actions of everyday people.
Yeah, exactly.
Just everyone doing a little bit will make such a difference.
It's exciting.
It's exciting indeed. aren't they taking the tax off soon, off sanitary products?
I think...
Is there a deadline for that to stop?
I'm not sure. I think I knew we were up to somewhere with it, but I don't know. I knew we were doing it, I think, but I don't know where we're up to with it.
I'll have to look at that and come back next time with an answer.
Yeah.
All right, well, I really like the title of this, the name of the website. Let's go there. That's my way in, is Girls Are Awesome.
Nice.
Which is...
Can't disagree.
Yeah, I mean, just... And this is an article by Hannah Jenkins, and I'll just go ahead and read the title of it.
Mm-hmm.
This amazing documentary explores gender equality in Iceland through the eyes of pro snowboarder Anne Floor Marxer.
Ooh, Marxer.
Yeah, but what do you
mean? Just nothing, just ignore me.
So the documentary is called A Land Shaped by Women. And it opens with Anne Floor Marxer saying that they decided to make this film when they realised that Iceland had been ranked number one for gender equality for 9 years in a row.
Nice.
I think that was by the United Nations as well, that ranking. The mini documentary, which you can watch on YouTube, it's just there when you need
How
it.
How mini?
Like under 10 minutes.
Okay, I like that.
Yeah, it's what we need. So the mini documentary follows Marxer and her friend Eileen Bock as they snowboard, surf, wakeboard and camp their way across Iceland in winter.
Okay, as you
hardcore.
Do.
Yeah.
And
along the way, they interview women who speak about the equality in their country.
Mm.
It features a human rights lawyer, a polar explorer, a founder of a clothing brand, a feminist performer, and two Icelandic teenagers.
That's a lot for a short documentary.
Yeah, they pack it in there. It's really hopeful and uplifting.
You've seen it?
Yes. Yeah. No, I just heard about it. Yeah, and I think it's... Sometimes it's really, like, the world's really depressing and... In some ways, equality seems so progressive and regressive, all in the same token. Mm-hmm. Like, even in those countries that you think should be super, like, equal, you'll always find things that are not.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So this is just a really wonderful and something to restore your hope in humanity.
I hope so.
Yeah. Just a nice, a little good feel thing
that
we'll definitely share on socials.
Yeah,
so.
Of course.
Yeah, that's my other thing on my radar. What have you got on yours?
To watch. Less hopeful, I'm afraid. Significantly. Less
All right.
Hopeful. Very negative, in fact. But I'm gonna talk about it anyway. So this is an article. This is from an article by Caitlin Burns on Rewire News, which I hadn't heard of before.
I haven't come across that either.
Found today. We're going to the US and we're going to see one of our least favourite people. Maybe our least favourite person, I'm afraid. Mr. Trump.
No.
Not directly, but okay. So
you just said we're going to the UN to see Trump.
Yeah.
I'm not filled with good feelings.
No, don't be. So this is about a conference called Make Families Great Again, which is as worrying as it sounds. Mm. So the Trump administration officials and prominent anti-choice activists appeared at a conference hosted by the Hungarian embassy earlier this month, designed to promote government policies to encourage women to have more babies.
We spoke about that. Maybe like last episode. Not this thing exactly. Talking about remember reproductive fascism.
Oh yeah.
And like Hungary was one of the examples.
Yeah.
That they like pay.
Well, Trump is.
Is he suggesting that?
He's been to a conference at the Hungarian embassy, essentially, seemingly to try and learn about the Hungarian model.
Yeah. If anyone that doesn't remember, a little refresher, in Hungary, for every like second and subsequent child, you get more money, like as like a government payout.
Yeah.
And the whole idea is that they need more Hungarian people because everyone's leaving.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah. No, this goes into this a bit as well, I think.
All right, okay.
So worryingly, Hungary's programs that we just spoke about, that you spoke about in whatever episode that was, we should probably put that in the notes, have drawn interest from the Trump administration and US conservatives who support its anti-choice and LGBTQ priorities. So
LGBTQ priorities.
Anti-LGBT.
Okay.
Did I say?
Pro-choice and LGBT. I was like, no. What a combination.
Who support its anti-choice and anti-LGBTQ priorities.
Okay.
So one of the speakers at the event, a Hungarian speaker at the conference, said, "We are working closely with the US administration on family issues. They would also like to get some detail on our pro-family policies and the measures that we have introduced in the last 9 years. This is a very worrying development."
With all of the problems that America is having in terms of, you know, no healthcare for a lot of people, like, and they want to put more children into the system.
I know. I suppose a slight silver lining, if we could see a silver lining here, I mean, the willingness and the active desire of the US government to engage with this conference and this ideology, the slight silver lining would be that Tony Perkins, the president of Anti-Choice and Anti-LGBTQ Family Research Council, who also spoke at the event, wrote about it afterwards and stated that from his communication with the US government at the event, I guess, he noted that the US isn't likely to support direct subsidies to increase the birth rate, given how out of line it is with what is considered, in inverted commas, best practice in other countries. Mm-hmm. Basically, given Hungary is such an outlier in terms of this policy, it seems unlikely that the US would attempt to adopt a similar policy. But it doesn't stop the concern being there for the interest in it, I suppose.
Yeah, the fact they had a conference about it.
It was the Hungarian embassy that held the conference. It was the US that... Yeah.
Oh, but they wanted... The US wanted the conference, or...?
I don't know if they had... I don't know.
That's fine.
Yeah, it was... Yeah, they attended it, which is the worrying part.
Yeah, well, let's hope that doesn't happen. Again, mine is entirely unrelated, bit of a random one. But my friend sent this over, like, for your podcast. Aww. I was like, well, yeah, I'll use it. Go on then. Emma Haruka Iweo smashes Pi World Record.
Oh my God, I love this.
As a title, that could be taken two ways. Yeah. I was going to say so many ways. No, just two. But it's Pi, just the P and the I.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh. Hannah told me about this before and I was so excited.
Did you think it was pie as in...
I thought it was pie eating.
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's rubbish. No, it's not. Go on.
The pie world, that does sound exciting.
Yeah.
This is also quite exciting if you're into maths.
Well, I don't care about maths. I want to talk about pies.
Well, we're going to talk about another kind of pie.
Fine.
They're like a dorky maths teacher, yeah. like trying to get the class excited. So the value of the number pi, which is the number you get when you divide a circle's circumference by its diameter, has been calculated to a new world record length of 31 trillion digits.
Why are they doing this? Why are they still doing this? Who's asking them to? It's like those tweets that you see where it says, like, no one ever,
yeah.
Colon, and yeah, and then it's just mathematicians. We got more digits for pi! No one asked.
Like, I think it's just like a, like, proving how great you are at maths.
I suppose so. Yeah.
They do use it.
What's the film where they, the guy remember?
Rain Man.
No. It's a different.
Pi. Life of Pi.
Life of Pi! Shut up, it actually is.
No, it's not.
It is! He's called Pi because he remembered all. Not all them digits to pi.
3 trillion yeah. digits. And then befriended a tiger.
Mm.
Yeah, that's how this article ends, actually. Yeah,
natural course of action, isn't it?
The past record was 22 trillion. So she really outdid it.
Jesus Christ.
So Emma Emma Haruka Iweo, a Google employee from Japan, found the new digits with the help of the company's cloud computing service.
Okay.
The first digits, 3.14, are well known, but the number is infinitely long. And extending the known sequence of digits in pi is very difficult because the number does not follow a set pattern. Which I, yeah. So
that doesn't make any sense to my brain.
That's why it's a big thing. Yeah. It's like, you just don't know what's going to be next. Okay. What's the next number? I don't know.
Okay. But in fairness, how would we know if they were just... We wouldn't know if they were just saying they'd found the numbers and were adding them on one by one. Like,
they might have to prove it somehow.
I'm sure they do, but like... I don't know. Who's going to fucking check? Like,
Nope. Fun fact, to wrap up my news, Google announced Emma's record-breaking discovery on Pi Day.
Which kind?
The Pi kind.
Please tell me there's some pie in this story.
There's loads of pie.
No, Hannah, good there's pie.
There's 30-something trillion. which is March 14th, if you ever cared to celebrate Pi Day.
Maybe we should start.
Maybe we shouldn't.
Okay. Never mind.
Not going to remember next year.
No. Well...
That's all the little bits on my radar.
Good for her.
Yes, it's a real achievement if you like maths.
Yeah, I'm sure some people do.
Or computers. I've heard
that people do. Shall I tell you a story?
I'm so ready for a story.
I'm quite excited to say this one, I think.
So, badass woman from History Time.
Yeah. I love her. Wait, I've got a picture of her that I need to put up and look at while I talk.
Okay.
That was the idea.
As your muse.
Yeah, I want to be inspired.
The most subtle. So much chaos is happening. We've got a new setup and we're not used to it.
I just crash into things in this place anyway. Like, it is quite... It's not small, but, like, it's getting used to a new layout and stuff, isn't it? Like, I've just been walking into things all the time.
And I just spilt my beer, so it's going well.
It's okay. So... I'm taking you today to Kenya.
I'm excited.
Yeah. So this is the story of Wangari Mute Matai. She was born in the village of Ihitha in Nyeri in the central highlands of Kenya in 1940. Her family was Kikuyu, which is the most populous ethnic group in Kenya, and had lived in the area for several generations.
Mm-hmm.
Around 1943... Matai's family relocated to a white-owned farm in the Rift Valley, near the town of Nakuru, where her father found work. Late in 1947, she returned to Ihitha with her mother, as two of her brothers were attending primary school in the village, and there was no education available on the farm they had moved to with their father. He stayed at the farm while the rest of the family moved back to Ihitha. Shortly after, at the age of 8, she joined her brothers at Ihitha Primary School. Aged 11, Matai moved to St. Cecilia's Intermediate Primary School, a boarding school at the Matari Catholic Mission in Nyeri. She studied there for 4 years, and during her time there, she became fluent in English and became a Catholic. She was involved with the Legion of Mary, whose members aimed to serve God by serving fellow human beings. That's a way of serving God I can get behind.
Mm-hmm. Not all religion is bad.
No, it's all right sometimes. So, studying here, she was sheltered from the ongoing Mau Mau uprising, which forced her mother to move from their home to an emergency village in Ihida. Basically, it was a pretty politically unstable time in Kenya.
The Mau Mau is the fascist government?
I think so.
Okay.
It doesn't go into much detail about it. Yeah.
Okay.
When she completed her studies there in 1956, she was rated first in her class and was accepted into the only Catholic high school for girls in Kenya, Loretta High School in Limuru. She did good.
No,
oh, you're referring at Loretta?
Yeah.
Because there's a Loretto College in there.
Yeah, Loretto High School, like, from around the corner from where I went. There's and I went there, one. But I didn't like it because they had nuns.
Oh, it must be. I was going to look into it and I forgot because I laughed at that as well. I was like, there is definitely a Loretta here.
Yeah,
There's a few around here.
There's a few around here?
There's the one near you and then there's a sixth form on the way into town.
Is that? Yeah, anyway, Loretto.
This is Loretta, yeah. But I'm assuming it's, yeah.
It's all related.
It's all related. So, blah, blah, blah. So she was first in a class. She got into the only Catholic high school for girls in Kenya, which is pretty big deal. As the end of East African colonialism approached, Kenyan politicians, such as Tom Mboya, were proposing ways to make education in Western nations available to promising students. John F. Kennedy, then a US senator, agreed to fund such a program through the Joseph P. Kennedy Jr. Foundation, initiating what became known as the Kennedy Airlift or Airlift Africa. Matai became one of 300 Kenyans selected to study in the US in September 1960.
That seems very exclusive.
Yeah, she did good. So the she received a scholarship, so she was selected to study in the US, and she received a scholarship to study at Mount St. Scholastica College, which is now Benedictine College, in oh my god, I phonetically spelled all of the Kenyan words, and then there's an English one though. Atchison, Kansas.
it's
basically my surname. where she majored there in biology with minors in chemistry and German.
Oh wow, German's hard.
Yeah, and not the hard. Chemistry or the biology, just the German. So after receiving her Bachelor of Science degree in 1964. She studied at the University of Pittsburgh for a master's degree in biology. Her graduate studies there were funded by the Africa America Institute, and during her time in Pittsburgh, she first experienced environmental restoration when she saw local environmentalists campaigning to rid the city of air pollution.
Oh.
Spoiler alert, the environment is relevant to this story.
Yeah, it's not where I was expecting it to go.
In January 1966, Matai received her Master's of Science.
Yeah.
Master's of Science? Is it of? Okay.
Yeah. I would just keep saying yes to reassure you. It's all okay.
Matai received her MSc in Biological Sciences and was appointed as a research assistant to a professor of zoology at University College of Nairobi. Upon returning to Kenya, Matai dropped her forename, preferring to be known by her birth name, Wangari Muta. I tried to do some research about the naming system in Kenya because I don't know which of these... I don't know what the difference between a birth name and a forename is in this context, but from here on in, I think we're going to refer to her as Wangari Muta. But we'll see, because it depends what I've written.
be a good surprise for both of us.
Yeah. However, when she arrived at the university to start her new job, she was informed that it had already been given to someone else.
No.
Yeah. She later said that she believed this to be because of gender and tribal bias.
Oh.
So after a 2-month job search, Professor Reinhold Hoffmann from the University of Gießen in Germany offered her a job as a research assistant in the microanatomy section of the newly established Department of Veterinary. I practiced this so many times.
You did it then. You did it then when you said I can't.
Veterinary. Yeah. Veterinary.
You put a bit of an Irish twang in it that I quite like.
Department of Vet Anatomy in the School of Vet Medicine at the University College of Nairobi.
School of Vet Medicine.
I can't do it. I actually really practiced that one as well. In April of 1966, she met Mwangi Maathai, another Kenyan who had studied in America, who would later become her husband. Oh. Don't get excited.
No.
She also...
So much drama.
I know. She also rented a small shop in the city and established a general store in which her sisters worked. She does everything.
She really does.
She's smashing it.
Yeah. She doesn't forget about anyone.
I know. I love her. I love you. In 1967...
Nina said that while looking at the picture, by the way.
In 1967, at the urging of Professor Hoffmann, she travelled to the University of Gießen in Germany in pursuit of a doctorate. She studied both there and at the University of Munich, and in the spring of 1969, she returned to Nairobi to continue studies at the University College of Nairobi as an assistant lecturer. In May of that year, she and Mwangi Maathai were married. And later in the same year, she became pregnant with her first child while her husband was campaigning for a seat in Parliament, which he narrowly lost. But still, they're doing a lot.
They are, aren't they? Killing it in every field.
They're really they go ham. During the course of the election, Tom Mboya, who had been instrumental in founding the programme which sent her overseas, the guy I told you about before, he was assassinated. And this led to President Kenyatta effectually ending multi-party democracy in Kenya. And so this is the political climate that she is now raising a family in. And shortly after this, Waweru, her first son, was born. In 1971, she became the first Eastern African woman to receive a PhD, her doctorate in vet anatomy.
Go on, go for it.
Veterinary.
Yeah.
Veterinary anatomy from the University College of Nairobi. Yeah. From the University College of Nairobi. She completed her dissertation on the development and differentiation of gonads in bovines.
Beautiful. Just wonderful. I can't wait to read it. I'm going to go find it online right now.
Bless. I love it. Her daughter Wanjira was born in December 1971, and then a few years later in 1975, Maathai became a senior lecturer at the University of Nairobi. A year after that, she became chair of the Department of Veterinary Anatomy, and in 1977, an associate professor. She was the first woman in Nairobi to be appointed to any of these positions.
Wow! Yeah. Oh my God. It's like breaking glass ceiling after glass ceiling.
Oh, and she does.
All right.
So, during this time, she was also campaigning for equal benefits for the women on the working staff of the university.
Boss.
Going so far as trying to turn the Academic Staff Association of the university into a union in order to negotiate for benefits. The courts denied this bid, but many of her demands for equal benefits for women were later met. In addition to her work at the University of Nairobi, Maathai became involved in a number of civic organisations in the early 1970s. She was a member of the Nairobi branch of the Kenya Red Cross Society, becoming its director in 1973, as you fucking do.
She's not busy enough.
I know,
for
yeah. She was a member of the Kenya Association of University Women, and following the establishment of the Environment Liaison Centre in 1974, Maathai was asked to be a member of the local board, eventually becoming board chair. The list of shit she does is just truly endless, but I'll keep going. Mm. The Environment Liaison Centre worked to promote the participation of non-governmental organisations in the work of the UN Environment Programme, whose HQ was established in... I wrote HQ to shorten it. I didn't mean to say it. Whose headquarters? Whose headquarters was established in Nairobi following the UN Conference on the Human Environment held in Stockholm in 1972. Matai also joined the National Council of Women in Kenya. Through her work at these various many volunteer associations, it became evident to Matai that the root of Kenya's problems was environmental degradation. I always say that wrong. In 1974, she gave birth to her third child, a son called Muta. Her husband, again, around this time, was campaigning for a seat in Parliament, hoping to represent the Langata constituency, and was this time successful. During his campaign, he had promised to find jobs to limit the rising unemployment in Kenya. These promises led Matai to connect her ideas of environmental restoration to providing jobs for the unemployed. This, in turn, led to them founding EnviroCare Limited, a business that involved the planting of trees to conserve the environment, involving ordinary working people in the process. This is a little bit of foreshadowing, I suppose.
Okay. Foreshadowing in a good way?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the first little seedling. Very appropriate.
So punny.
Yeah, you'll see. So this led to the planting of her first tree nursery. EnviroCare ran into multiple problems, primarily regarding funding, and ultimately the project failed. However, this was never going to be a total loss. It was so even though the EnviroCare Limited company failed, what came out of it was that she was sent to the first UN conference on human settlements, known as Habitat One, in June 1976.
The first one?
Yeah.
Oh my god.
In 1977, Matai spoke to the National Council of Women in Kenya concerning her attendance at this event. She proposed further tree planting, which the council supported. On June 5th, 1977, marking World Environment Day, the National Council of Women in Kenya marched in a procession from Kenyatta International Conference Centre in downtown Nairobi to Kamukunji Park on the outskirts of the city, where they planted 7 trees in honour of historical community leaders.
Aww.
The imagery of trees in her story is just fucking beautiful. Like, it's everywhere and they're just so symbolic and lovely. I love it. This was the first green belt, which was known as Save the Land, which was known as the Save the Land Harambe, and then became the Greenbelt Movement, which is what you need to remember now. That is what we're talking about
Green
now.
Greenbelt Movement. Yeah. Got it. Stored in my brain box.
So, Matai encouraged the women of Kenya to plant tree nurseries throughout the country, searching nearby forests for seeds to grow trees native to the area. She agreed to pay the women a small stipend for each seedling, which was later planted elsewhere. In her 2010 book, Replenishing the Earth, Spiritual Values for Healing Ourselves and the World, she discussed the impact of the Greenbelt Movement, explaining that the group's civic and environmental seminars stressed the importance of communities taking responsibility for their actions and mobilising to address their local needs, and adding, "We all need to work hard to make a difference in our neighbourhoods, regions and countries and in the world as a whole. That means making sure we work hard, collaborate with each other, and make ourselves better agents to change." This is all very positive and lovely.
Mm-hmm.
And trees are great, but I'm going to go back to her personal life a little bit.
Okay. I don't like the tone shift.
Yeah. No, trees are so nice. I just love trees.
Let's talk about trees for a while longer.
I'll go back to trees.
Okay, cool.
But for now, we're doing a little bit of divorcey. So
divorcey.
Yeah,
you just repeat it twice. Don't make it better.
Yeah, it's like nicer, isn't it? After a lengthy separation, they separated in 1977. Mwangi filed for divorce in 1979. He was said to have believed Wangari was too strong-minded for a woman, and that he was unable to control her.
Oh, well, someone's got insecurities.
In addition to naming her as cruel in court filings, he publicly accused her of adultery with another member of parliament, which in turn was thought to cause his high blood pressure, and therefore the judge ruled in Mwangi's favour.
No way! Mm-hmm.
It's insane. Shortly after the trial, in an interview with Viva magazine, Matai referred to the judge as either incompetent or corrupt. The interview later led the judge to charge Matai with contempt of court. She was found guilty and sentenced to 6 months in jail.
No!
Yeah.
For, like, just defending her honour?
Yeah. Ugh. Well, it was all pretty much bullshit anyway. They got divorced because she was too strong-minded.
Mm-hmm.
And then for calling fucking court out on it, she goes to prison. However, after 3 days in Langata Women's Prison in Nairobi, her lawyer formulated a statement which the court found sufficient for her release.
That's good. Good lawyer.
Spoiler, that's not going to be the first time she's in prison.
That's an exciting life.
Honestly, I didn't realise it was this turbulent, I think, when I started, because I was interested in the environmental stuff, and then I was like, fucking hell, it really, like, she's really been through some shit. So shortly after the divorce, her former husband sent a letter via his lawyer demanding that Matai drop his surname. She chose instead to add an extra A to it, so it's M-A-A-T-H-A-I, when his surname is M-A-T-H-A-I. She just chucked in an extra A. She was like, well, it's different.
I love it.
I love that. However, the divorce had been costly. And with the lawyer's fees and the loss of her husband's income, Matai found it difficult to provide for herself and her children on her university wages. An opportunity arose to work for the Economic Commission for Africa throughout the UN Development Programme. As this job required extended travel throughout Africa and was based primarily in Lusaka, Zambia, she was unable to bring her children with her. She made the difficult decision to send them to her ex-husband and take the job. She visited them regularly, but they pretty much lived with their dad until 1985. Mm. In 1979, Matai ran for the position of chairperson of the National Council of Women in Kenya.
It's
really creepy. And it sounds like someone pissing. So the National Council of Women in Kenya was an umbrella organisation consisting of many women's organisations in the country. The newly elected president of Kenya at the time, Daniel Arap Moi, tried to limit the amount of influence those of the Kikuyu ethnicity held in the country, including in volunteer civic organisations such as the National Council of Women in Kenya. So this is where she's just running for a position of chairperson, which she lost. She didn't get the position of chairperson, but was overwhelmingly chosen to be the vice chairperson of the organisation. So the following year, she runs again. Again, she was opposed, she believes, by the government. When she ran for the election the following year and it became apparent that she was going to win, Mandeleo ya Wanawaki, a member organisation which represented a majority of Kenya's rural women and whose leader was close to Arap Moi, withdrew from the National Council of Women in Kenya. And therefore, Matai was elected chairperson of the National Council of Women in Kenya. If I say NCWK from now on, will you follow that?
Yeah.
Do you think?
I mean, I can do, listeners, can you do it? Are you with us?
I'm going to keep saying, okay.
So we're now
The NCWK is the National Council of Women in Kenya.
Cool. Yeah, I'll switch that.
Write it down if you need to. You'll be fine. I think I wrote it down. Yeah, I did, because I kept forgetting as well. So basically now she's been elected as the chairperson of the NCWK. However, Mandeleo ya Wanawaki came to receive a majority of the financial support for women's programs in the country, and the NCWK was left virtually bankrupt. So basically they gave her the role because they knew they were gonna
fuck them.
They would shut her up, but they weren't going to give her the same funding that organisation had always had.
That's so evil and underhand.
Honestly, all of this is absolutely bonkers for how fucked up and... What's the word I'm trying to say?
Big meanies.
Big meanies. There's another one that's more aggressive. Corrupt.
Corrupt.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. Corrupt. Yeah. Future funding became more and more difficult to come by, but the NCWK survived by increasing its focus on the environment and making its presence and work known. Matai continued to be re-elected and serve as chairperson of the organisation every year until she retired from the position in 1987. So once she was in, she was in. It was difficult for funding, but the people that were part of this organisation really respected her, and she stayed chairperson until she decided to leave. So she's not one to be put off by anything. She's faced a lot of challenges at this point, but she's still going. And in 1982, the parliamentary seat representing her home region of Nyeri was open, and Matai decided to campaign for the seat. As required by law, she resigned her position with the University of Nairobi to campaign for office. However, the courts decided that she was ineligible to run for office because she had not re-registered to vote in the last presidential election in 1979. Matai believed this to be false and illegal and brought the matter to court. The court was to meet at 9 in the morning, and if she received a favourable ruling, she was required to present her candidacy papers in Nyeri by 3 in the afternoon that day. So they're giving her loads of strict, tight deadlines just to make things difficult and try and make her not run for this seat.
Okay. Seems fair.
Yeah. And... The judge disqualified her from running for this position in office on some kind of technicality which isn't listed, but it seems very trivial, and they just didn't want her to do it. So bearing in mind that she'd left her job at the university to campaign because that's what the law asks that you do, she hasn't got the seat, she requests her job back, and they say no.
No.
Mm-hmm. Also, she was living in university housing because she was a member of staff, but as she's no longer a member of staff, she gets evicted.
No!
Mm-hmm.
It's all at once.
I know. And bear in mind, this was all just to campaign for something. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't like she got something and like lost something. She lost everything. Okay. So she'd purchased a house somewhere else. Before the house just pops up from somewhere, she's got a small home somewhere, so she moves there and continues to focus on the NCWK while she searched for work. So in the course of her work through the NCWK, she was approached by Wilhelm Elsrud, executive director of the Norwegian Forestry Society. We like him. He wished to partner with the Green Belt movement and offered her the position of coordinator. Employed again, Matai poured her efforts into the Greenbelt movement. Along with the partnership for the Norwegian Forestry Society, the movement had also received seed money, from the UN Voluntary Fund for Women. These funds allowed for the expansion of the movement, for hiring additional employees to oversee the operations, and for continuing to pay a small stipend to the women who planted seedlings throughout the country. Am I saying that right, stipend?
Yeah, that's how I would say it. Also, she's like so international.
I know.
With everything.
She
like,
just fucking smashes it.
She goes to America, it's like for her education. She goes to Germany to become a teacher. And now she's like working with Norwegians.
I know. It's just great. She's honestly I'm blown away by this woman. I'll try not to get too emotional at this point. I'll save it for the end.
Okay.
Blah, 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 blah. So she's working with the Norwegian Forestry Society, and this allowed her to refine the operations of the movement. She could also pay a small stipend to the women's husbands and sons who are literate and able to keep accurate records of seedlings planted. Basically, she's just, what she was talking about before about creating jobs by using the environment, she's just completely, yeah, she's just smashing it. She's creating jobs for people and employing locals, and yeah, it's all great. Around this time, the UN held the third Global Women's Conference in Nairobi. During the conference, Matai arranged seminars and presentations to describe the work the Greenbelt Movement was doing in Kenya. She escorted delegates to see nurseries and plant trees. She met Peggy Snyder, the head of UNIFEM, and Helvi Sepila, the first woman appointed as UN Assistant Secretary General. She's doing that networking.
Yeah.
The conference helped to expand funding for the Greenbelt Movement and led to the movement's establishing itself outside Kenya. In 1986, with funding from UNEP, the movement expanded throughout Africa and led to the foundation of the Pan-African Greenbelt Network. 45 representatives from 15 African countries travelled to Kenya over the next 3 years to learn how to set up similar programmes in their own countries to combat desertification, deforestation, water crises and rural hunger. The attention the movement received in the media led to Matai being honoured with numerous awards. The government of Kenya, however, they're not very supportive, are they? Demanded that the Greenbelt Movement separate from the NCWK, believing the latter should focus solely on women's issues, not the environment. Therefore, in 1987, Matai stepped down as chairman of the NCWK and focused on the newly separate non-governmental organisation. In the latter half of the 1980s, the Kenyan government came down against Matai and the Greenbelt Movement. The single-party regime opposed many of the movement's positions regarding democratic rights. They invoked a colonial-era law prohibiting groups of more than 9 people from meeting without a government licence. They're really just so... They just don't want her to exist.
They really don't.
They'll just do anything.
They keep putting all these obstacles in her way, and she keeps, like, she's just avoiding them, going over them, going under them, doing so much better, and...
They don't stop.
And they just don't get the message, don't get the hint, like... Can't stop her.
So one of the great things about the Greenbelt Movement was the fact that it was so economic, it was so about creating jobs for people... And it was so, in its way, political, which was what the government didn't like.
Mm.
In 1988, the Greenbelt Movement was carrying out a lot of pro-democracy activities, such as registering voters for the election and pressing for constitutional reform and freedom of expression. According to Matai, around this time, the government was carrying out electoral fraud in the elections to maintain power. Which doesn't seem like a stretch from what I've read about it. And I'm inclined to believe anything she says. In October 1989, Matai learned of a plan to construct the 60-story Kenya Times Media Trust complex in Uhuru Park.
No.
Yeah. The complex was intended to house the headquarters of KANU, the Kenya Times newspaper, a trading centre, offices, an auditorium, galleries, shopping malls and parking space for 2,000 cars. The plan also included a large statue of President Daniel Arap Moi, who we don't like. She wrote, I was debating whether or not to keep this in, because she wrote a lot of letters of protest, and it lists here all the people she wrote the letters to, and I don't think I'll read them all, because it is so wordy, but it's a lot of people, and it's globally, it's the UN, it's... Within Kenya, she's really doing hard on the letter writing protesting.
Yeah. Highly underrated.
Yeah. She also wrote to, one of the people she did write to was Sir John Johnson, who was the British High Commissioner in Nairobi, urging him to intervene with Robert Maxwell, a major shareholder in the project. And in this letter, she wrote about how constructing this tower in Uhuru Park would be akin to building in Hyde Park or Central Park, these sacred green spaces, essentially. Not sacred, not the right word, but yeah.
Yeah, like...
It's green space, that's what it's...
Like protect? I don't know if they are protected green spaces, but like landmark green spaces, yeah.
So the government refused to respond to her inquiries and protests, instead responding through the media and stating that Matai was a crazy woman, that denying the project in Uhuru Park take no more than a small portion of public parkland, and proclaiming the project as a fine and magnificent work of architecture opposed by only the ignorant few. On the 8th of November 1989, Parliament expressed outrage at Mattai's actions, complaining of her letters to foreign organisations and calling the Greenbelt movement a bogus organisation and its members a bunch of divorcees.
Wow.
They're so...
So grown up about it.
I know, it's bizarre. They also suggested that if Mattai was so comfortable writing to Europeans, perhaps she should go live in Europe. What a great comeback.
Yeah.
Primary school.
Sick burn.
Yeah. Fucking idiot. So, despite her protests, as well as popular protests growing throughout the city, the ground was broken at Uhuru Park for construction of the complex on the 15th of November 1989. Mattai sought an injunction in the Kenya High Court to halt construction, but the case was thrown out on the 11th of December. In his first public comments pertaining to the project, President Daniel Arap Moi stated that those who opposed the project had insects in their heads. Of course.
So stupid.
No.
I'm going to use that.
Got fucking insects in your head. On 12th of December in Uhuru Park, during a speech celebrating independence from the British, President Moi suggested Mattai should be a proper woman in the African tradition and respect men and be quiet.
Mm.
Yep.
Not something we haven't heard before, mate.
So she was forced by the government to vacate her office and the Greenbelt movement was moved into her home. The government then audited the Greenbelt movement in an apparent attempt to shut it down. Despite the government's response, Mattai's protests and the media coverage it garnered led foreign investors to cancel the building project in Uhuru Park in January 1990. It wasn't constructed.
Wow. Nice. She stopped it.
Yep.
Good.
She gets shit done. In January 1992, it came to the attention of Mattai and other pro-democracy activists that a list of people... That a list of people were targeted for assassination and that a government-sponsored coup was possible. Guess whose name was on the list?
No!
Yeah, yeah. So Mattai's name is on a list that has been leaked that apparently the government is planning to assassinate.
All she wanted to do was plant trees.
You know, and support democracy. So the pro-democracy group, known as the Forum for the Restoration of Democracy, presented the information it had found about this list to the media, calling for a general election. Later that day, Mattai received a warning that one of their members had been arrested and she decided to barricade herself into her home. Shortly thereafter, police arrived and surrounded the house. She was besieged there for 3 days before police cut through the bars she had installed on her windows, came in and arrested her. Yep.
I am speechless.
Yeah, I know. It's like...
It's like a film.
I know. Honestly, this is what I was thought I was reading a story about trees, and then it's like, it's really fucking escalates, doesn't it?
There should be a... Is there a movie? There should be a movie.
There's documentaries, but there should be, yeah.
Yes.
So she and the other pro-democracy activists who had been arrested were charged with spreading malicious rumours, sedition, which is inciting people to rebel against the government, and treason. After a day and a half in jail, they were brought to a hearing and released on bail. A variety of international organisations and 8 senators put pressure on the Kenyan government to substantiate the charges against pro-democracy activists or risk damaging relations with the US. So that's good. And in November 1992, the Kenyan government dropped the charges. So...
She's got the support of the world, just like her own government.
Another part of, so when she was released on bail from, when she got arrested from her house, Mattai and some of the other democracy campaigners took part in a hunger strike in a corner of Uhuru Park, which they labelled Freedom Corner, to pressure the government to release political prisoners. This is like obviously before the charges have been dropped, I'm just backtracking a little bit. But after 4 days of the hunger strike, on the 3rd of March 1992, the police forcibly removed the protesters. Violently. So Matai and three others were knocked unconscious by police and hospitalised. President Daniel Arap Moi called her a madwoman and a threat to the order and security of the country. Says the man that's ordered a peaceful hunger strike to be forcibly removed and, like...
And, like, sent in, like, police officers. Yeah, exactly, to a load of... Woman.
Yeah. So, unsurprisingly, the attack drew international... There's pictures of this as well. I've seen pictures of this. It's horrible. The attack drew international criticism. The US State Department said it was deeply concerned by the violence and the forcible removal of the hunger strikers. When the other prisoners were not released, the protesters, mostly mothers of those in prison, moved their protest to All Saints Cathedral, the seat of the Anglican Archbishop in Kenya, across from Uhuru Park. The protest there continued, with Matai contributing frequently until early 1993, when the prisoners were finally released. So that's almost a year that they were trying to get these prisoners released.
That's very, very dedicated.
You know. During this time, Matai was recognised again with various awards internationally, but still the Kenyan government did not appreciate her work. In 1991, she received the Goldman Environmental Prize in San Francisco and the Hunger Project's Africa Prize for Leadership in London. CNN aired a 3-minute segment about the Goldman Prize, but when it was aired in Kenya, that segment was cut out. So in June 1992, so before the prisoners got released, this is still during that protest at Uhuru Park, both Matai and President Arap Moi travelled to Rio de Janeiro for the UN Conference of Environment and Development. The Kenyan government suggested to the leaders of the summit and told them that she should not be allowed to speak at the summit because of her protests at Uhuru Park. They claimed that she was inciting women and encouraging them to strip at Freedom Corner. I don't understand why they get this shit. Like, they were on a hunger strike. It's completely fucking bonkers. But despite this, Matai was chosen to be chief spokesperson at the summit.
Good.
They
know a lie when they see it.
I know. So during the first multi-party election of Kenya in 1992, Matai strove to unite the opposition and for fair elections in Kenya. So the Forum for the Restoration of Democracy, which I mentioned before, had fractured into Ford Kenya and Ford Asili. And basically Matai believed that such a fractured opposition would not be able to defeat KANU's control of the country. So it's complicated.
So she wanted to, like, reunite the opposition.
Yeah, basically she's trying to reunite the opposition to the Kenya African National Union. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. So she formed a group called the Middle Ground Group in an effort to unite them. She was chosen to serve as chairperson, because that's what she does. Sat in a lot of chairs in her life. And she also, during that time, formed the Movement for Free and Fair Elections, which is like another pressure group thing, I guess. Despite these efforts, the opposition did not unite, and the ruling KANU party, the Kenyan African National Union, used intimidation and state-held media to win the election, retaining control of parliament. The following year, ethnic clashes occurred throughout Kenya. Matai believed that these were incited by the government, who had warned of stark consequences to multi-party democracy. Matai travelled with friends and the press to areas of violence in order to encourage them to cease fighting. With the Greenbelt movement, she planted trees of peace, but obviously before long, her actions were opposed by the government. the conflict areas were labelled as no-go zones, and in February 1993, the president claimed that Matai had masterminded a distribution of leaflets inciting Kikuyus to attack Kalenjins, the two ethnic groups.
It's just completely made
up. Yeah. So after her friend and supporter, Dr. Makanga, was kidnapped, Matai chose to go into hiding. While in hiding, she was invited to a meeting in Tokyo of the Green Cross International. It just doesn't stop. Which was an environmental organization recently founded by former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev.
All right.
She responded that she couldn't attend because she was in hiding.
I may have to declare the invitation.
So Gorbachev pressured the government of Kenya to allow her to travel freely. They denied that they were limiting her travel. So she was allowed to leave the country, but she was too late for the meeting in Tokyo.
Mate, I'm with you there.
So in 1993, she flew to Scotland to receive the Edinburgh Medal. In May, she went to Chicago to receive the Jane Addams International Women's Leadership Award. And in June, she attended the UN's World Conference on Human Rights in Vienna.
She's such a globetrotter.
She really is. And then she's done that for a bit and then goes back to politics. So during the elections of 1997, Matai again was devoted to uniting the opposition to defeat the ruling party. And in November, less than 2 months before the election, she decided to run for parliament and for president as a candidate of the Liberal Party.
Sick.
Her intentions were widely questioned in the press. Many believed she should simply stick to running the Greenbelt movement and stay out of politics. And on the day of the election, a rumour was printed in the press that Matai had withdrawn from the election and was endorsing another candidate. Not true.
No.
So because of this, she got no votes and lost the election.
That's horrible!
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Completely mental. So in the summer of 1998, Matai learned of a government plan to privatise large areas of public land in the Karura Forest, just outside Nairobi, and give it to political supporters. She again begins protesting through letters to the government and the press, and she went with the Greenbelt movement to Karura Forest, planting trees and protesting the destruction of the forest. On 8th of January 1999, a group of protesters, including Matai, returned to the forest to plant a tree in protest. The entry to the forest was guarded by a large group of men. When she tried to plant a tree in an area that had been designated to be cleared for a golf course, the group was attacked. Many of the protesters were injured, including Matai, four MPs, some of the journalists, and German environmentalists. When she reported the attack to the police, they refused to return with her to the forest to arrest her attackers. However, the attack had been filmed by Matai's supporters and the event provoked international outrage. She's got the world behind her.
Yes.
She might not have Kenya behind her, but she's got the world behind
her. She has many, many Kenyan people.
Yeah.
Just,
not the government, yeah.
Those in the pocket of the government. Mm. Hand in hand pocket. I don't know what the analogy I want to go for is.
So the attack's been filmed, international outrage, student protests broke out throughout Nairobi, and some of these groups were violently broken up by the police. It's alright. Protests continued until 16th of August 1999, when the president announced that he was banning all allocation of public land. In 2001, the government again planned to take public forest land and give it to its supporters. While protesting this and collecting petition signatures, on the 7th of March 2001, in Wanguru village near Mount Kenya, Matai was again arrested. The following day, following international and popular protest, she was released without charge. 2001, July, she's planting trees at Freedom Corner in Uhuru Park in Nairobi to commemorate Saba Saba Day. In 2001, she was planting trees at Freedom Corner in Uhuru Park and was again arrested. And once again, later that evening, was released without being charged. In 2002, she returned to teaching as the Dorothy McCluskey Visiting Fellow for Conservation at the Yale University School of Forestry and Environmental Studies.
That's a lot of words. Yep. Well done.
She stayed there for a few months, teaching a course on sustainable development, focusing on the work of the Greenbelt movement. Upon her return to Kenya, again, she campaigned for parliament in the 2002 elections, this time as a candidate of the National Rainbow Coalition, the umbrella organisation which finally united the opposition. On 27th of December 2002, the Rainbow Coalition defeated the ruling party, the KANU, Kenya African National Union, and in Tetu constituency, Matai won with an overwhelming 98% of the vote.
Really?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So when KANU's been defeated in that government,
everyone loves
Matai. So, in January 2003, she was appointed assistant minister in the Ministry for Environment and Natural Resources and served in that capacity until November 2005. She founded the Mazingira Green Party of Kenya in 2003 to allow candidates to run on a platform of conservation as embodied by the Greenbelt movement. She was awarded in 2004 a Nobel Peace Prize for her contribution.
Just when you thought there was a glass ceiling. Nope.
For her contribution to sustainable development, democracy and peace. She had received a call from Ole Danbolt Njoss, chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, on 8th of October, informing her of the news.
Okay.
She became the first African woman and the first environmentalist to win the prize.
That's so good.
In 2006, she was one of the 8 flag bearers of the 2006 Winter Olympics opening ceremony. And so later that year, in August 2006, US Senator Barack Obama travelled to Kenya. His father had been educated in America through the same program as Matai. He was one of the 300 that got sent.
Really? Yeah.
What? I know.
Oh my God!
This story, man. This story.
Small freaking world.
Small freaking world. So she met with Mr. Barack Obama and planted a tree with him in Uhuru Park in Nairobi. And Obama at the time called for freedom of the press to be respected, saying press freedom is like tending a garden. It continually has to be nurtured and cultivated. The citizenry has to value it because it's one of those things that can slip away if we're not vigilant.
Yeah.
He deplored global ecological losses, singling out President George W. Bush's refusal to join the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change and the Kyoto Protocol. So in 2007, she was defeated in the Party of National Unity's primary elections for its parliamentary candidates and chose instead to run as the candidate for a smaller party. She was defeated in this election. She called for a recount of votes in the presidential election in her constituency, saying that both sides should feel the outcome was fair and there were no indication of fraud, which I think there happened. Loads more, like, you'll have to just go and look at her list of awards and stuff because it does just go on. But in 2011, she sadly died of complications arising from ovarian cancer while receiving treatment at a Nairobi hospital. The Greenbelt movement is still going, and the Wangari Maathai Institute for Peace and Environmental Studies, which she created in 2004, continues to be a part of the University of Nairobi and aims to democratise connections between university students and the faculty and the communities they serve. Yeah.
That's amazing.
There's so much more I could say about her. I watched a documentary about her, and she's just so chill. Her presence is amazing. She's just, her values cannot be shaken. She was always optimistic. She never gave up, which absolutely. I know I feel like we say a lot, but like the adversity, and she knew what she felt was right to do and would not be shaken from it.
Absolutely. Yeah, she stuck by her convictions the whole time. And her vision of like how she wanted the world, her country, her community to be.
Her care for people and the environment so simultaneously, it's so holistic, and just like she's so like economically minded, politically minded. Honestly, I'm blown away by her. Like, I get excited about all the people we talk about, but I've never had it as much as with her, and I think I say that every time, but like really, she's something else. She's phenomenal. I've ordered her autobiography. I'm gonna put that picture on my wall because I fucking love her. Like, she's just brilliant.
Yeah, she is really cool. Like, we, especially right now, we need more of that mentality.
Yeah,
like our environment needs us to look after it.
I know,
so badly. And that whole, like, you know, she wanted to create jobs through environmental work. We've seen protests in, I mean, probably for us, like in the Western world lately, against creation of jobs through fracking or reopening coal mines or reopening, I think it's oil in America.
Yeah.
And there is other options. We need, like, put that money into the environment instead. So, big inspiration.
Love her.
Do you know what that documentary was called?
I'm Taking Roots, I think.
Okay. Somewhere along... Well, we can put
if
it
you
in
search it. Her name, there's actually loads of interviews with her and stuff as well. But that documentary is really, really great. And it's really just... You can see her vision. And it's all just women working, planting trees. And it's just... It's really beautiful. Like, yeah. It's lovely. Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much. That's I love right. that.
I love her.
Yeah, that's great.
I guess we done?
Well, I think we're done.
Yeah.
So at the end of the show, we'll be closing with another song from a returning artist, Amal, who is a Somali Canadian R&B artist.
Mm-hmm.
And her latest single is called Coming and Going. So enjoy that at the end.
Yep.
As per, Nina's gonna call out the socials for you.
Okay, yeah. So you need to go and give us a like, give us a follow. We are on Twitter at That's What She Pod, Instagram, That's What She Said _podcast, and on Facebook, That's What She Said Podcast.
Yep, that's
and
it.
We need your support.
We would love to hear from you.
So, yeah, I hope you've enjoyed.
Yes. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
You're speaking with your body, your emotions make connections under me, and I feel like it, cause you're making waves with yourself. You're taking my mind and putting it down.